88% of the workweek is spent communicating, so it's important your team does it well. Enter Grammarly. Grammarly's AI helps teams communicate clearly the first time. It shows you how to make words resonate with your audience, helps with brainstorming, and lets you instantly create and revise drafts in just one click. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who use Grammarly to move work forward. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise ready AI.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. People always say it's good to unwind, but that's easier said than done. The exception, Chumba Casino. They actually make it easier done than said, or at least the same. Chumba Casino is an online social casino with hundreds of casino-style games like slots and blackjack. Play for fun. Play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Sign up now and collect your free welcome bonus at chumbacasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a compassionate guide for those seeking to heal and thrive. Introducing your host, Monique Cohen, a certified trauma recovery coach and fellow traveler on the path to healing. In this podcast, we will engage in heartfelt conversation with experts in the field of trauma healing. We'll explore ways to cultivate feeling safe in our bodies and in connection to others, so that we can be present to live the life we've been given more fully and with more joy. Join us as we navigate the way towards a life restored. Introducing your host, Monique Cohen.
Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast. My name is Dr. Mark McNear, and I will be your guest host today. I'm filling in for my good friend, Monique Cohen, and today I am really grateful and excited to have J.S. Park with me. And J.S., maybe you could introduce yourself to our audience and tell them a little bit about your work with grief.
Sure. Well, Dr. Mark, thank you for having me on, and Monique, thank you also. Yes, I'm a hospital chaplain. It's been now 9 years and a month that I've been a chaplain. And so I work at a level one trauma center. It's 1,000+ beds. Level one traumas, we get crises, emergencies, such as gunshot wounds, stabbing, fire, fall, car accident, stroke, drowning, the hardest stuff that you'll see. And part of my role is to attend traumas, code blue, death, to assist and support with end of life decision making and end of life care. And so a lot of my role is listening. This podcast today may be the most that I talk all week. And I offer support and assistance for patients who are navigating through very often the worst day and moment of their lives. And the technical definition, I think, of a chaplain is non-anxious, non-judgmental, comforting presence.
Yeah, we're gonna get it.
That. So, you know, I've joked before that I'm a cross between a priest and a therapist or a therapist. And so sometimes our work's very technical. You know, we do like the end of life. Who do you want your healthcare surrogate to be? A decision maker? What's in your living will? We may talk about some of those decisions, but also sometimes it's just sitting with a patient and allowing them to tell their story. Sometimes I call families to do next of kin notifications or finding family for our patients as we establish their identity. And then other times it's a lot of talking about death and mortality and what it means now as this patient enters illness and injury and dying.
Yeah, I want to also mention to our audience that you are an author, and I have your book here, and I've been going through it, and I just want to hold it up here as long as you need. And it's just, I just want to say, John, I'm so grateful. I said this before we came on with the listeners, but I am so grateful that you took the time to write this book. It is a powerful book. It's not what I really appreciated as a therapist is it's not a book that's step one, step two, step three. This is how you do it. It's something you're wrestling with. At least that's what I found, that I wrestled with it all the way through. I found myself smiling at times and laughing. And then I found myself last night in tears, you know, with some of the stories that you do such a great job in talking about. So I went from anger to sadness to laughing to joy, you know, it just all over the spectrum. And I really, really want to thank you again for writing this book. It's an important work for sure.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I think it's in chapter three, you talk about, June, is that you run to grief. You can't help it. Can you help us with that?
Sure. Well, thank you for reading the book, Dr. Mark. I really, really appreciate that. It means a great deal that anybody would read anything I've written or said. But yeah, running into grief. And you said, you used the term, was it grief catcher?
Grief catcher, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, grief is something that all of us are going to experience. And I would say it's something we experience around the clock. And it is something that we, I think, are inclined to suppress or deny or ignore. And maybe for good reason, because it is so hard to experience the fullness of our response to loss, to really look loss in the face and to allow every range of emotion to enter. But I think there are two kinds of pain. One is the actual pain of grief itself, the loss itself. And then there is an additional pain that we can bear when we suppress that grief. And that's a pain that we often place on each other or ourselves, to say things like, just be strong, don't cry, you'll be fine, don't worry about it. You know, or religious cliches like, you know, this is happening for a reason, or God's refining you through the fire, all those kinds of unhelpful things. So part of my role as a chaplain, a grief catcher, is to remind my patient and their families of their permission to be able to say, this is terrible and awful, and this hurts, this loss is, it's hard. To be able to say that out loud without shame, to not have to suppress that or deny it, but really to validate and accept everything that they're experiencing. And, you know, grief catcher can mean several different things. You know, when my patients literally fall on the floor because of bad news they receive, or when their families are falling over, I sometimes literally catch them. Other times it's my patients and their families and staff too, when they are shouting in rage, screaming, rolling on the floor, or sometimes even clapping and dancing, whatever emotional expression, extreme expression that they exhibit or express in that room, I'm there to catch it. I vicariously go through what they're going through. Something I often tell family members as almost kind of giving them a permission slip to feel is, I'll tell family members, when you see your loved one going through something, you go through it too. In other words, family members who see patients, their loved one, suffering through whether it's cancer, a car accident, or an unknown illness yet to be diagnosed, when they see their loved one suffering, they suffer too. And so in that way, we all catch grief when we're with each other. And then I guess the other thing is, when I visit patients, when I go to deathbeds, when I see the dying, they can't always talk. They're not always able to communicate. But I may ask the family, what is this person like? And it gives them room to share what they love about this person, almost like a pre-eulogy. And as they're sharing, I'm catching these stories about this person I've never met before. And though they may be dying or have died, I catch them in some way, their story, and they become alive. And so in that way, I'm catching grief, and grief being almost a remembrance or a resurrection of what was lost. And so that's my sacred honor to be able to do that.
I love the fact, and correct me if this is wrong, you know, I love the fact that you give so much space for grief. Like I got that in reading the book, and I've also listened to a lot of your work, and you just talk about giving people so much space. And I don't think we're particularly good at giving people space to grieve without stepping in and trying to shrink their pain.
Yeah, and I'm sure you can tell me also and correct me as well from your own work, Dr. Mark, that we sometimes are fed a myth or a social narrative that grief is wrong or expressing grief is wrong. So there's always this, I guess, shrinkflation or shrinkage that happens when it comes to any kind of emotional expression. Like, you know, keep the past in the past, or seeing tears is somehow wrong and you got to keep that down. And I'll see patients literally beating their own chests, you know, trying to stop their tears, or apologizing over and over if they start to weep. or saying things like, I'm afraid if I start crying, I won't be able to stop. And I'm thinking, well, maybe that's the right place to be right now, is just to let that happen. Now, I've been doing this now 9 years, but I continually find myself in new situations and new rooms and new ways of grieving. You know, I didn't know before that grief could manifest itself as anger. And anger is something that makes people very uncomfortable in general. It's something that's very hard to be around. And it could be because of triggers in our own stories where we only have seen anger as something violent and harmful. But those who experience loss, why shouldn't they be angry? Loss is just this disturbing, insulting thing to really think about and to really endure and experience. So I say all that to say, the more space that I can make, the more room in my heart that I can make, I think that allows somebody in their grief not to feel ashamed, not to feel ridiculed or smaller. My good friend and coworker, Larry, chaplain and Reverend Larry, he says this thing. He says, grief takes up a lot of room. It takes up a lot of room. And it needs that room to breathe. It needs that room for that person to be able to be embodied in their own selves. And I really think, as hard as loss is, the only way really through it is to be able to make as much room and space as possible for it.
That's so good. So good. You mentioned other people's stories, and I want to move into your story of trauma. And I just want to say to the listeners, I got permission before moving into this to ask you, you know, to talk about your own story of trauma.
Yeah.
And healing.
Yeah. Thanks for asking that, Dr. Mark. And, you know, I'm always open and willing to talk about that. Thank you for asking for permission, too. That's very kind of you. And I think, you know, I think that's something that we can all take a note from, about asking for permission. So thank you for that. Yeah, I didn't know how much trauma I had suffered and experienced until I took the ACE test in my chaplain internship.
And okay, if you could help people with the ACE.
Sure, of course, yeah.
ACE is, yeah.
So the ACE score, Adverse Childhood Experiences, that came out of the results of a study/survey that was done, I think, with 17,000 plus people. You know, we know in psych stats that N is important, right? N equals, yeah, 17,000 plus. And then I think they expanded it to maybe 24,000. But they ask 10 questions. And the more that you answer yes to questions like, have you ever seen your parents assault each other? Have any of your family members ever been in jail? Have you ever been physically harmed, etc.? So the more you answer yes to, the higher of doses of trauma you've experienced as a child. And there's a strong correlation between the imprint of trauma that you have and then physical illness. And so, for example, if you have an ACE score of 4 or higher, it's said that your chances of depression, anxiety, heart attacks, even brittle bones, loss of self-control and impulse control, those kinds of things drastically increase. And so when I took the ACE test, Adverse Childhood Experiences, I answered the questions, I scored a 9 out of 10. And I remember telling the psychologist who was hosting this class that they were doing, I asked, so am I just doomed then to, you know, 3,000% yeah, heart attacks and, you know, 1,500% depression? And the psychologist, she is a very kind doctor. She worked with children. She said, no, you're not doomed. She said, there's something called resilience that we can learn. And, you know, I think the important takeaway for me from that day was being able to name the word trauma and to understand that some of the depression, anxiety, distress that I felt in my own body was not my fault, but was imprinted upon me because of childhood abuse and bigotry that I experienced. You know, my parents both physically and verbally abused me. And I know that they were doing the best they can. That's what we say about parents very often, right? I think they tried. And at the same time, I suffered a lot of physical and verbal abuse. And then at school, growing up here in the States, lots of bigotry. I was often the only Asian in the classroom in Florida. And so all of that coalesced and accumulated into and I think for those wondering, why do I have difficulty with concentrating, focusing. I have cognitive fog, depression, anxiety. You know, there's biological and psychological reasons for that, but also social reasons, the way that we grew up.
Yes. Yeah.
The events that happened to us, the way that our childhood was shaped. And so that's something I didn't know, I want to say, until about 8-9 years ago when I started chaplaincy. I have maybe inklings of it, but then I full on got the education. And that's important to kind of get a grip on our own stories and to really try to start understanding how can I heal my way through this. But it's naming it first that was the key to it.
Yeah, and before we moved to you being a non-anxious, non-judgmental presence for people, you know, you got that score, and then what did you do?
You know, so when I got the score, it was one of those things that I was surprised and not surprised, you know? And I was so glad that in the chaplain program, we had so many resources. You know, I had one-on-one supervision with my supervisor, which we do throughout staff chaplains as well, past the education, we continue that. But I would say about 4 years ago now, and I should have done it sooner, but 4 years ago, I started to see a regular therapist. And then I also started to take medication for my depression and have been on it since. So no shame in either of those things. I hope anybody listening, anybody watching would know, no shame in either of those things at all. In fact, a lot of liberation and healing in those things. And I began to do EMDR. I had a trauma therapist. And so
if you can tell people what EMDR is.
Yeah, EMDR is eye movement desensitization reprocessing. Now, funny thing, Dr. Mark, and I'm sure you know this, is you know, studies can't show why it works.
They don't know
the
they
exact.
They know it does, but they don't know why.
It's almost like, you know, SSRIs, we don't know exactly why they work either all the time. But EMDR, for some reason, has a very high success rate of being able to tap into trauma and to start to almost, in a sense, unlock the body from trauma responses.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
You know, the therapist walks you through some of your, it's almost like a stroll down trauma lane as they talk about the most traumatic things that happened to you, and you focus on either their finger or a pen, or there's sometimes a computer screen with a dot that bounces back and forth. And as your eyes are following that, and then you're cognitively kind of going through some of the traumas that happen, there is something in the brain that is able to process and reprocess our responses to that. And there's some studies that say, I think 8 or so EMDR sessions, and your body almost rewires its response to previous trauma.
Yeah.
I can tell you, I had, and I'm a very, like, I need empirical studies and evidence-based stuff. I tend to be very skeptical. I became a Christian very late in life just because of all the skepticism. I grew up atheist. And so when I went to EMDR, I was highly skeptical. I was like, is this hypnosis? You know, what are they doing with this, moving my eyes back and forth? I just thought, you know, I'll try it. And I happened to get state funding for it. So I thought, might as well, because it is very expensive. So I was very lucky and privileged to get that. But it had a massive, enormous response to it. And I don't want to make it sound like some kind of miracle cure, because it is very hard work. But I'm so glad that a lot of my responses to trauma, shutting down and being really, really overwhelmed by stress, experiencing severe depression and anxiety, even if somebody were to say like a hard and harmful thing to me, I would often have disproportionate responses to that.
Sure, sure. And I think that's trauma, is having disproportionate responses to things.
88% of the work week is spent communicating, typing, talking, and going back and forth on topics until everyone is on the same page. It's time for a change. It's time for Grammarly. Grammarly's AI ensures your team gets the point across the first time, eliminating misunderstandings and streamlining collaboration. It goes beyond basic grammar to help tailor writing to specific audiences. Whether that means adding an executive summary, fine-tuning tone, or cutting out jargon in just one click. 4 out of 5 professionals say Grammarly's AI boosts buy-in and moves work forward. It integrates seamlessly with over 500,000 apps and websites, is implemented in days, and is IT approved. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who trust Grammarly to elevate their communication. Visit grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly, enterprise ready AI.
Hey, it is Ryan Seacrest. There's something so thrilling about playing Chumba Casino. Maybe it's the simple reminder that with a little luck, anything is possible. ChumbaCasino.com has hundreds of social casino-style games to choose from with new game releases each week. Play for free anytime, anywhere for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I learned that in chaplaincy, that term. Anybody who's listening, if you look up your own state, and this is a little bit of a side note, but VOCA, Victims of Crime Act, is how I was able to get free EMDR. If you're a victim of a crime when you were younger, when you're a minor, you are eligible to get free therapy, including EMDR, trauma therapy. So I was very lucky for that, and it's really helped, and I'm still doing it. And I'm tapping through all the stuff. And Dr. Mark, I'm remembering things that my brain actively forgot and I think blocked to protect me.
Yes.
But I have learned that even as your brain blocks to protect those things, it still lives in your body.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that. But, such a thing that Monique and I have been talking about, just the importance of the body in relation to emotions, in relation to trauma. Absolutely.
Yeah, it lives there. The body doesn't lie, and the body remembers. Yeah, sometimes it's not, they say that CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, is not enough often for PTSD or for trauma. And so I'm so glad for modalities like EMDR and things that don't require as much talking. Not everyone's into the talk therapy, but anyone who's listening, if you can find those resources, there's so much out there that is helpful, and EMDR is just one of the many ways that I've found. But it's finding out first, hey, I got this thing, and it's a big obstacle in my own life.
It's interesting, June. I just want to share this with our listeners. And I was doing research for this program, and I started watching some YouTube videos and some work that you've done. And I guess one of the hazards of being a therapist is you just notice how people show up. And I noticed right away with you, you had done a lot of work and a lot of good work for you to show up the way you do. And I want you to hear that, and I want listeners to realize that putting the hard work in really makes a difference in how they show up for themselves and for others.
Thank you, Dr. Mark. I really appreciate that you said that and noticed it. I'm embarrassed to say 9 years ago in my internship, when I first started as a chaplain intern, there was and I think I wrote this in the previous book, there was a room that I panicked and I almost basically ran away from this room.
Sure.
Because of my anxiety response. And I'm sure that disproportionate reaction came from an overlapped or a connection to my own story somehow.
Yeah.
And those kinds of things, they live in the body and we respond disproportionately. As messy humans, we're never going to respond perfectly to everything. But there is stuff where trauma lives in the bones. It lives in the veins where the story of trauma will just pop up and it'll have us responding and reacting in ways that can be harmful to ourselves or others. Yeah. I hope for anyone listening, if this is the first time you've heard this, it's so important that in those traumatic moments that happen in our lives, those resources, the community that we enter, the people that we talk with, the books that we read, all of those can really set the path for how we recover from that trauma. Yeah. Dr. Mark, you've seen this interesting study, and feel free to cut this from the episode, but this interesting study where those who experience traumatic moments, within a certain time frame, if you play Tetris, you have a higher chance of post-traumatic growth. And it's a weird thing,
right?
Because there's something about the eye movement and that's linked with the EMDR. And so, there's something about moments after where the physicalness, because our bodies and our brains are all connected, our hearts, all of it, our spirit, our soul. Yeah, and so I don't know what it is about Tetris and eye movement and also even the things that we hear, like the way that the news is broken. I've heard of, for example, people who, they get the call in the middle of the night from law enforcement or highway patrol, your loved one, et cetera, et cetera. Or I have to make those calls as a chaplain from the hospital. That call can be a traumatic call in itself.
Absolutely.
And how do we soften and cushion and buffer that so that there's gentleness, so that in itself doesn't become an additional trauma? And so I guess I'm saying all this to say, the ways in which we are able to have those resources, not everyone gets them. But those initial beginning resources are so important to set the trajectory through how we navigate our trauma.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. So you talk about being a non-anxious, non-judgmental presence, and I'm curious what that means. And certainly, you know, I think about the work you've done, and I think about the fact that you can do that now, mm-hmm. where I'm not so sure you could have done that 10 years ago. I don't know, but with a nine, or I have my doubts.
Yeah, well... You know, when we think of someone who's not a good listener, you know, not a good listener, it's someone who has probably some kind of anxious, nervous energy where it looks like they want to be somewhere else. Yeah. There's kind of a frantic and frenetic pace about them where they're sort of doing this or looking for other people in the room or checking their watch or can't get off their phone. That's sort of an anxious energy that people can have, or they're not able to keep eye contact for very long, or there's something about where they almost want to always jump in and say something as you're talking. And so that hurriedness, that freneticness, that's a lot of anxious energy in the room. And for someone who's experiencing loss and trauma, chaplains are so important in that a patient in the hospital, they have a swirl of activity around them, nurses, PCTs or surgeons, physicians, different specialists, all coming in the room, asking them necessary questions, giving them test results, or I need to take blood pressure, I got to do a blood draw, or we got to go to the CT or X-ray, you know, all these different things. So this patient can feel like they're being moved around a lot or being asked and demanded a lot of things, or they're trying to rest and then 3 a.m, it's time to check blood pressure. Yeah. All those kinds of things. A chaplain, when I enter, I try to be a non-anxious person where I don't need anything necessarily from my patient. I don't have test results. I don't have a diagnosis. So some people may say, well, what's your point or purpose then? But I think it's to bring this peaceful presence to the patient that they can start to say out loud and verbalize what is happening to them and inside them in the midst of all this swirl of activity and this traumatic thing that is happening. And so I bring that non-anxious, it's a different kind of energy. I don't want to say it's no energy, but it is a different kind of energy where suddenly the patient who's like this can go and talk to a person who really cares and is interested. And the non-judgmental part, Dr. Mark, you in your own work, I'm sure run across this. You ever have somebody tell you a story about how they ended up where they are? In the middle of it, you almost want to raise your eyebrows and go, goodness, you know, you feel a little bit of maybe, you know, and I say this for myself, a little bit of.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. To be able to hold the story without judgment is really important.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure your clients, just as my patients, they can tell when someone's judging them. They can tell, you know, with the raise of an eyebrow or, you know, I think I read this somewhere from maybe it was Dr. Irvin Yalom. He's one of my favorite authors, Gift of Therapy.
Sure.
Yeah, fantastic. But there's like a stock non-judgmental response from a therapist is you just say, that's interesting. You know, you don't say, oh, wow, that's good or bad. You just say, that's interesting.
Yeah,
you know, and that can be helpful. And also, if somebody's listening and knows what that means, they're like, oh, they're trying not to judge me right now.
Yes.
Yeah. But there are times when I'll talk with a patient and, I'm thinking, wow, there's a lot in your story where you made some decisions that maybe you shouldn't have. However, this person who is talking to me, they're in a mode of almost confession / building a narrative and making sense and meaning out of what is happening to them.
Yes.
And in that moment, I'm there and I am beholden to the moment. I don't judge them for the decisions they made previously. I don't hold them against how they got there. I am just here in this moment. And that sort of non-judgmentalism requires a very deep compassion and empathy. And for me to try to take their perspective and think, if I grew up how they grew up in the same conditions and situations and choices, I may have ended up exactly where they are, if not worse. If I had the same resources, the same community and people around me, I may have ended up there. And so I'm very mindful of how I respond and react. You know, they say something like 60 or 70% of our communication is nonverbal. It's
Absolutely.
Body language.
Yeah.
And if I raise an eyebrow or if I twitch my head a little bit, that can give away that, hey, I'm judging this person. And I want them to feel safety in my presence. And as a reflection of, for some patients, I reflect in some ways divinity or something bigger than us, maybe even God's love. And so in that sense, if I'm reflecting that with my chaplain badge, I want to make sure that I'm reflecting that in a way that the universe is showing them care and compassion, even if it's just through this one person, you know? And so that's a really important thing that I think I bring to the room, an important role that I'm always mindful of.
You talk about not moving beyond grief, but becoming bigger. Is that something that resonates with you, or am I getting that right? Or, you know, that idea that we need to kind of move with the grief, not move beyond it, or to distance ourselves from it. And in order to do that, we need to become emotionally bigger.
Yeah. You know, I think that alluding to earlier, the common myth or what we're taught is that we need to move on and let go and turn the page when it comes to our losses. And it makes sense to me that we would want to think that or say that to someone else, because that's almost a compassionate response. I don't want to see you hurting. I don't want to hurt anymore. So how can I move on from this and let it go? But ironically, the inverse happens when we try to suppress or deny or ignore or move past it. It becomes this buried yet very toxic and harmful thing to avoid the emotional response to our loss. And Dr. Mark, you know that when we bury our stories, when we suppress our trauma, when we don't give room to process and talk about it, it can become big in our own lives, even if we're not looking at it, and big in a way that hurts us and harms us, that can weigh us down. And so I've seen, again, so many patients who they've been almost, I want to say, this is a strong word, but I think they've been indoctrinated socially and religiously to believe that grief is this poison that has to be worked out of our bodies. But I think grief is a legitimate and real and authentic response to loss that is something our body needs and is not to be avoided. And in that sense, grief can make us bigger, has the potential to do that. And I don't want to say, I want to be careful that I'm not saying, oh, grief is this opportunity to become a better person. I don't want to say that at all. I don't want to say, oh, pain is going to teach you this lesson. That's the wrong corollary, right?
Yeah.
But rather, when I encounter and enter grief, and my friend John, who died 5 years ago, when I remember him, I let the memory wash over me and I embrace and remember what it was like to share a laugh with him, to eat food together with him. And in that sense, remembering him rather than suppressing him, the remembrance is what makes me bigger, because his memory, who he is, the joy and the wonderfulness of John, what an amazing person he was and is, it does make me bigger to remember him. And he becomes almost this companion to me. Now, I know not every loss can be like that. There are hard losses. There are complicated losses. But I think it's grief which is the funnel by which we can fully experience who we are in the moment. And when it comes especially to people that we've lost, they do become a part of us. They do become a companion. And I think letting go and moving on and turning the page on them is can be harmful. You know, when we think of Western culture and the way that it's treated death, we pump a body with formaldehyde and we bury it 6 feet underground in a box. And that's kind of a modern invention.
Yeah.
You know, to jettison a person and their belongings and their body apart from us, when every other culture in the world and throughout history has kept the dead close and remembered. And so I think that's an important thing to remember our losses. Koreans, we have, in Korean culture, we have Chesa, which is death day. We commemorate not only birthdays, but death days. We remember our ancestors every year. And that makes us bigger by sharing their memory and allowing them to be a part of us in our everyday.
You know, and I think you talk about also rituals, the importance of possible rituals. Can you give us an idea about that?
Yeah. So, you know, just as there is Chesa in Korean culture, you know, I'm reminded of how in so many cultures, I'm going to recommend a book called From Here to Eternity by Caitlin Doughty. I think she was a funeral director and then traveled the world to look at, I believe, what she calls death engagements. And she noticed that every culture in the world, except the West in particular, maybe like a Euro and Anglo-Saxon culture, there's a high death engagement in particular Eastern cultures. And she looked at, for example, Dia de los Muertos, where in Mexican culture, there are shrines and pictures that are devoted and dedicated to matriarchs and patriarchs who have gone on before, who have passed away. But it's remembering them and keeping them. And there's another culture, and I know I'm going to get it wrong, but in the summers, I believe there's a particular tribe or people who they exhume their matriarchs and patriarchs from their burial place and then sit them up at the breakfast table and have tea with them. And in the West, I think when we hear something like that, that sounds gross, or that sounds like, you know, we can't let go of the past. But these kinds of rituals, being able to keep the dead with us, it does allow us to recognize grief as something that makes us more human and that it's a shared community experience. So whatever rituals we need, I think, for example, I still talk with John out loud, my friend. And you know, John was such a funny, interesting person and was just so like full of wonder all the time. Everything he saw, he was always, wow, wow. And I want to keep that. And I try to see through his eyes in that way. John was just this tall, funny, good looking blonde, like 6'2", maybe, you know. And part of my ritual is I'll still talk with him. If there's something that happens, that's great. I'll tell him. If there's something that's happened, that something happening hard, I'll talk with him about it. But yeah, I think there are rituals that we can partake in, whether it's cultural, part of our heritage, or personal to us, or something that our therapist offers us that can help us to navigate the hardness of loss. I'm reminded of, there's a book called The Grieving Brain. I think it's by, I'm forgetting the author right now, Mary Frances O'Connor. I could be saying that wrong. But she's a therapist who talks about how there's a woman who lost her husband, and every night she was so distraught. She still cooked two meals every night and she would throw one away. And then her therapist did something called, I think it's fairly new, CGT, complicated grief therapy. And I think the old ways of therapy, maybe from the 80s or 90s, would have told her, hey, you need to stop doing that. Just start cooking the one meal and then that'll help you, you know. But instead, this therapist doing the CGT said, you know, when you cook the two meals a night, is there something you could do with that second meal? And so she slowly began to give the second meal over to a church that would feed the unhoused in the area and also deliver meals to people who couldn't leave their homes. And then she just started cooking batches and batches of meals. And that sort of became her ritual as a way to remember and to grieve her husband. You know, we may think of grief as just sadness, just hardness, but I think grief should also include the ritual, the remembrance, the resurrecting of all that was lost. That can mean so many different things, but if there's just one thing that would be helpful for you, whether it's one time or repeating, it's those rituals that will help us get through it.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you. You know, one of the things that I have about 42,000 questions more I'd like to ask you, but for time's sake, June, I'm going to move to the body. And I love the fact that you, in your work, talk about the body and how important the body is. And I think in Western culture, a lot of times we cut it here, you know, and we have everything from the neck up instead of the whole being, you know. But I wanted to ask you in our closing, like, what role does the body play in grief?
Yeah, so, you know, I see two things when I see a grief response. I see an emergent response, meaning that which emerges immediately as an involuntary grief response. And then I also see conscious and intentional grieving, which could be called mourning. So when someone has a grief response that's involuntary, that they're not really in control of, you see the whole body in movement. And for some people, I'll see them throw themselves. I've seen people punch the wall, seen people rolling on the floor. I've even seen, as people are almost can't contain themselves, shaking and clapping and rocking back and forth. And so the entire body is involved. They say that grief comes in waves. And these waves can just wreck our entire body. And I think there's almost this myth, maybe, and I'm still kind of putting this together in my own mind as I'm like saying this out loud, but I think there is a myth that putting our whole body into it is a bad thing because we need to be still and we need to be reasonable, and you can't throw things and punch things, and you know, we can't be rolling on the floor. And I think even in hospitals or even in funeral homes, in social settings, there's almost like a, hey, we got to have some decorum here and some politeness, and you know, don't try to get too carried away and that sort of thing, you know. But then our entire bodies, they need that reaction. That is what's happening. And I want to present this one day to the boardroom or something at the hospital, but you know, can we just have a padded room where people can throw things and throw chairs and punch the wall if they need to, and then maybe another room that's just, you know, barbecue. Yeah, just what the body needs. It's a holistic response. And when it comes to conscious and intentional grieving, the choice that we make to mourn, sometimes we just may think that talk therapy or talking with someone is going to be enough. And sometimes it is in the moment, but our whole bodies need care, you know, whether that's a nap or soup, you know.
I love that. The whole body needs care.
The whole body needs care, all of it. And that could mean dancing. I've seen people in the room as their loved one is dying or has died. They'll all sing hymns or sing songs around this body. That's an intentional, conscious choice. I'm going to use my voice, my body, my throat, my singing, my vocal cords to mourn this person who has died. Or people even dancing and clapping their hands and things like that. They're using their entire bodies. And I've seen people think, oh, that looks strange, or that looks weird, or are they really grieving? And I think that that's an appropriate and wonderful and needed response. You know, and I've also seen people who, they experience cognitive fog, they're shut down, they're fatigued, or no tears, or they're just kind of scrolling through their digital dreamscape, and that's kind of what they need in that moment. Now, is there something, is there some moment where our bodies respond in a way that's harmful to us or to other people? Yes, I think so. I believe it. And at the same time, I think we do need to redefine and reshape our definition of the appropriate bodily response to grief. And we can make a lot more room for that, to allow room for that, and then also to address the ways in which we can mourn, whether that's journaling or art or clay or painting or running, physical exercise, dancing, or a hamburger. I do remember in my chaplain internship, we had a moment where we got to mourn some of our trauma. And our supervisor, she had these two exercises. She had this old fabric in one side of the table. And then she had a bunch of like these potted plant jars, I get like pottery, these empty jars.
Yeah.
And then she said, on this side, you can rend this fabric. You can tear it in half just to experience the tearing of the very physicalness of mourning the trauma. And it can mean whatever it means to you, whether you're tearing that trauma in half or this is how your body felt when you experienced trauma. And then with the pottery, we would wrap it in the fabric and then smash it with a hammer.
Interesting.
And that's a very physical way of expressing all of our emotions. And the physicalness of it is what we needed, what our bodies needed. You know, we live inside our bodies and our bodies need care. And that's so important as we take care of ourselves in grief.
Thank you for that. And I just want to thank you, June, for coming today. I want to thank you for your book. I want to thank you for your work. And I want to thank you for the work you've done, because it definitely shows up when you show up.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to ask you, if people want to follow you, where can they find you?
Yeah, I think I'm on all the things, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. And my book can be found at aslongasyouneedbook.com.
Right.
And yep, and that has all the links for all the places that it's sold.
And for social media, it's under JS Park, right?
That's right. That's exactly right.
Thank you, June.
Thank you, Dr. Mark. Appreciate you.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. Everybody needs some variety in life. That's what I love about Chumba Casino. They know how to keep things fresh and exciting. All their games are free to play, like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire, you can claim free daily login bonuses too. And they release new games every week. So spice things up with ChumbaCasino.com now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. And now, during our Veterans Day sale, save 40% on the Sleep Number Special Edition smart bed. Limited time. To find a store near you, visit sleepnumber.com.